Chapter 24. Comprising further particulars of Oliver's stay at Mr. Brownlow's, with the remarkable prediction which one Mr. Grimwig uttered concerning him, when he went out on an errand, Oliver soon recovering from the fainting fit into which Mr. Brownlow's abrupt exclamation had thrown him, the subject of the picture was carefully avoided, both by the old gentleman and Mrs. Bedwin, in the conversation that ensued, which indeed bore no reference to Oliver's history or prospects, but was confined to such topics as might amuse without exciting him. He was still too weak to get up to breakfast, but, when he came down into the housekeeper's room next day, his first act was to cast an eager glance at the wall, in the hope of again looking on the face of the beautiful lady. His expectations were disappointed, however, for the picture had been removed. ! Said the housekeeper, watching the direction of Oliver's eyes. It is gone, you see. I see it is, ma'am, replied Oliver. Why have they taken it away? It has been taken down, child, because Mr. Brownlow said that as it seemed to worry you, perhaps it might prevent your getting well, you know, rejoined the old lady. Oh, no, indeed. It didn't worry me, ma'am, said Oliver. I like to see it. I quite loved it. Said the old lady, good-humoredly. You get well as fast as ever you can, dear, and it shall be hung up again. There. I promise you that. Now, let us talk about something else. This was all the information Oliver could obtain about the picture at that time. As the old lady had been so kind to him in his illness, he endeavored to think no more of the subject just then, so he listened attentively to a great many stories she told him, about an amiable and handsome daughter of hers, who was married to an amiable and handsome man, and lived in the country, and about a son, who was clerk to a merchant in the West Indies, and who was, also, such a good young man, and wrote such dutiful letters home 4 times a year, that it brought the tears into her eyes to talk about them. When the old lady had expatiated, a long time, on the excellences of her children, and the merits of her kind good husband besides, who had been dead and gone, poor dear soul, just 26 years, it was time to have tea. After tea she began to teach Oliver cribbage, which he learned as quickly as she could teach, and at which game they played, with great interest and gravity, until it was time for the invalid to have some warm wine and water, with a slice of dry toast, and then to go cozily to bed. They were happy days, those of Oliver's recovery. Everything was so quiet, and neat, and orderly, everybody so kind and gentle, that after the noise and turbulence in the midst of which he had always lived, it seemed like heaven itself. He was no sooner strong enough to put his clothes on properly than Mr. Brownlow caused a complete new suit, and a new cap, and a new pair of shoes, to be provided for him. As Oliver was told that he might do what he liked with the old clothes, he gave them to a servant who had been very kind to him, and asked her to sell them to a Jew, and keep the money for herself. This she very readily did, and, as Oliver looked out of the parlor window, and saw the Jew roll them up in his bag and walk away, he felt quite delighted to think that they were safely gone, and that there was now no possible danger of his ever being able to wear them again. They were sad rags, to tell the truth, and Oliver had never had a new suit before. One evening, about a week after the affair of the picture, as he was sitting talking to Mrs. Bedwin, there came a message down from Mr. Brownlow, that if Oliver Twist felt pretty well, he should like to see him in his study, and talk to him a little while. Bless us, and save us. Wash your hands, and let me part your hair nicely for you, child, said Mrs. Bedwin. Dear heart alive. If we had known he would have asked for you, we would have put you a clean collar on, and made you as smart as sixpence. Oliver did as the old lady bade him, and, although she lamented grievously meanwhile, that there was not even time to crimp the little frill that beordered his shirt collar, he looked so delicate and handsome, despite that important personal advantage, that she went so far as to say, looking at him with great complacency from head to foot, that she really didn't think it would have been possible, on the longest notice, to have made much difference in him for the better. Thus encouraged, Oliver tapped at the study door. On Mr. Brownlow calling to him to come in, he found himself in a little back room, quite full of books, with a window looking into some pleasant little gardens. There was a table drawn up before the window, at which Mr. Brownlow was seated reading. When he saw Oliver, he pushed the book away from him, and told him to come near the table, and sit down. Oliver complied, marveling where the people could be found to read such a great number of books as seemed to be written to make the world wiser, which is still a marvel to more experienced people than Oliver Twist, every day of their lives. There are a good many books, are there not, my boy? Said Mr. Brownlow, observing the curiosity with which Oliver surveyed the shelves that reached from the floor to the ceiling. A great number, sir, replied Oliver. I never saw so many. You shall read them, if you behave well, said the old gentleman kindly, and you will like that, better than looking at the outsides, that is, some cases, because there are books of which the backs and covers are by far the best parts. I suppose they are those heavy ones, sir, said Oliver, pointing to some large quartos, with a good deal of gilding about the binding. Not always those, said the old gentleman, patting Oliver on the head, and smiling as he did so. There are other equally heavy ones, though of a much smaller size. How should you like to grow up a clever man, and write books, eh? I think I would rather read them, sir, replied Oliver. What? Wouldn't you like to be a book writer? Said the old gentleman. Oliver considered a little while, and at last said, he should think it would be a much better thing, to be a bookseller, upon which the old gentleman laughed heartily, and declared he had said a very good thing, which Oliver felt glad to have done, though he by no means knew what it was. Well, well, said the old gentleman, composing his features. Don't be afraid. We won't make an author of you, while there's an honest trade to be learned, or brickmaking to turn to. Thank you, sir, said Oliver. At the earnest manner of his reply, the old gentleman laughed again, and said something about a curious instinct, which Oliver, not understanding, paid no very great attention to. Now, said Mr. Brownlow, speaking if possible in a kinder, but at the same time in a much more serious manner than Oliver had ever known him assume yet, I want you to pay great attention, my boy, to what I am going to say. I shall talk to you without any reserve, because I am sure you are well able to understand me, as many older persons would be. Don't tell you are going to send me away, sir, pray. Exclaimed Oliver, alarmed at the serious tone of the old gentleman's commencement. Don't turn me out of doors, to wander in the streets again. Let me stay here, and be a servant. Don't send me back to the wretched place I came from. Have mercy upon the poor boy, sir. My dear child, said the old gentleman, moved by the warmth of Oliver's sudden appeal, you need not be afraid of my deserting you, unless you give me cause. I never, never will, sir, interposed Oliver. I hope not, rejoined the old gentleman. I do not think you ever will. I have been deceived before, in the objects whom I have endeavored to benefit, but I feel strongly disposed to trust you, nevertheless. And I am more interested in your behalf than I can well account for, even to myself. The persons on whom I have bestowed my dearest love lie deep in their graves. But, although the happiness and delight of my life lie buried there too, I have not made a coffin of my heart, and sealed it up, forever, on my best affections. Deep affliction has but strengthened and refined them. Apostrophe, as the old gentleman said this in a low voice, more to himself than to his companion. And as he remained silent for a short time afterwards, Oliver sat quite still. Well, well, apostrophe, apostrophe, said the old gentleman at length, in a more cheerful tone, I only say this, because you have a young heart, and knowing that I have suffered great pain and sorrow, you will be more careful, perhaps, not to wound me again. You say you are an orphan, without a friend in the world. All the inquiries I have been able to make confirm the statement. Let me hear your story, where you come from, who brought you up, and how you got into the company in which I found you. Speak the truth, and you shall not be friendless while I live. Apostrophe, Oliver's sobs checked his utterance for some minutes, when he was on the point of beginning to relate how he had been brought up at the farm, and carried to the workhouse by Mr. Bumble. A peculiarly impatient little double knock was heard at the street door, and the servant, running upstairs, announced Mr. Grimwig. Is he coming up? Apostrophe, apostrophe, inquired Mr. Brownlow. Yes, sir, apostrophe, replied the servant. He asked if there were any muffins in the house, and, when I told him yes, he said he had come to tea. Apostrophe, Mr. Brownlow smiled, and, turning to Oliver, said that Mr. Grimwig was an old friend of his, and he must not mind his being a little rough in his manners, for he was a worthy creature at bottom, as he had reason to know. Shall I go downstairs, sir? Apostrophe, apostrophe, inquired Oliver. No, apostrophe, replied Mr. Brownlow, I would rather you remained here. Apostrophe, at this moment, there walked into the room, supporting himself by a thick stick, a stout old gentleman, rather lame in one leg, who was dressed in a blue coat, striped waistcoat, nankeen breeches and gaiters, and a broad-brimmed white hat, with the sides turned up with green. A very small plaited shirt frill stuck out from his waistcoat, and a very long steel watch chain, with nothing but a key at the end, dangled loosely below it. The ends of his white neckerchief were twisted into a ball about the size of an orange. The variety of shapes into which his countenance was twisted defy description. He had a manner of screwing his head on one side when he spoke, and of looking out of the corners of his eyes at the same time, which irresistibly reminded the beholder of a parrot. In this attitude, he fixed himself the moment he made his appearance, and, holding out a small piece of orange peel at arm's length, exclaimed, in a growling, discontented voice, look here, do you see this? Isn't it a most wonderful and extraordinary thing that I can't call at a man's house, but I find a piece of this poor surgeon's friend on the staircase? I've been lamed with orange peel once, and I know orange peel will be my death, or I'll be content to eat my own head, sir. Apostrophe, apostrophe, this was the handsome offer with which Mr. Grimwig backed and confirmed nearly every assertion he made, and it was the more singular in his case, because, even admitting for the sake of argument, the possibility of scientific improvements being brought to that pass which will enable a gentleman to eat his own head in the event of his being so disposed, Mr. Grimwig's head was such a particularly large one, that the most sanguine man alive could hardly entertain a hope of being able to get through it at a sitting, to put entirely out of the question a very thick coating of powder. I'll eat my head, sir, apostrophe, repeated Mr. Grimwig, striking his stick upon the ground. Hallo! What's that? Apostrophe, looking at Oliver, and retreating a pace or two. This is young Oliver Twist, whom we were speaking about, apostrophe said Mr. Brownlow. Oliver bowed. You don't mean to say that's the boy who had the fever, I hope? Apostrophe said Mr. Grimwig, recoiling a little more. Wait a minute. Don't speak. Stop apostrophe continued Mr. Grimwig, abruptly, losing all dread of the fever in his triumph at the discovery. That's the boy who had the orange. If that's not the boy, sir, who had the orange, and threw this bit of peel upon the staircase, I'll eat my head, and his too. Apostrophe, no, he has not had one, apostrophe said Mr. Brownlow, laughing. Come, put down your hat, and speak to my young friend. Apostrophe, I feel strongly on this subject, sir, apostrophe said the irritable old gentleman, drawing off his gloves. There's always more or less orange peel on the pavement in our street, and I know it's put there by the surgeon's boy at the corner. A young woman stumbled over a bit last night, and fell against my garden railings. Directly she got up I saw her look towards his infernal red lamp with a pantomime light. Don't go to him, I called out of the window, he's an assassin. A man trap. So he is. If he is not apostrophe here the irascible old gentleman gave a great knock on the ground with his stick, which was always understood, by his friends, to imply the customary offer, whenever it was not expressed in words. Then, still keeping his stick in his hand, he sat down, and, opening a double eyeglass, which he wore attached to a broad black ribbon, took a view of Oliver, who, seeing that he was the object of inspection, colored, and bowed again. That's the boy, is it? Apostrophe said Mr. Grimwig, at length. That's the boy, apostrophe replied Mr. Brownlow. How are you, boy? Apostrophe said Mr. Grimwig. A great deal better, thank you, sir, apostrophe replied Oliver. Mr. Brownlow, seeming to apprehend that his singular friend was about to say something disagreeable, asked Oliver to step downstairs and tell Mrs. Bedwin they were ready for tea, which, as he did not half like a visitor's manner, he was very happy to do. He is a nice-looking boy, is he not? Apostrophe inquired Mr. Brownlow. I don't know, apostrophe replied Mr. Grimwig, pettishly. Don't know? Apostrophe Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.